You need it, that's for sure.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Pearson, who's Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley, the author of Off-Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy, and Politics in Time, History, Institutions, and Social Analysis. His latest book with Jacob Hacker is Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, which is just out in a new paperback edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Pearson.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And I noted that Bill Moyer started out his new PBS series with you and Jacob Hacker and your book, which really shows how over the last 30, 40 years, our political system has been hijacked by the super rich. Clearly, Bill Moyer's considered this the most important story around.
That's right. I mean, I think he told us that it was one of the reasons he wanted to come back on the air again was that he feels like these issues of growing economic inequality and the way that they generate a kind of vicious circle of increasing political power, which then translates into increasing economic power again, that this was just an issue that Americans really needed to understand and wrestle with.
Well, it seems to me, Paul Pearson, that at this point, the super rich are, in fact, displaying a kind of arrogance and hubris that's quite breathtaking. Having almost taken the global economy to a near-death experience, they were bailed out by the average taxpayer. Now they've been made whole. They clearly control our politics. We've seen that there's no way in the world that the Congress can in any way end the Bush tax cuts for the super rich, and they'll do everything. They'll hold the entire government hostage to maintain. They'll go to the mat for that. And now they're running a one percenter for a presidential candidate. Does that strike you as being a bit rubbing it in our face?
Well, I think there have been astonishing developments over the last couple of years in American politics, which really, I think, reinforce the story that Jacob and I are trying to tell in the book, and you've summarized them well. I mean, it is amazing to see, a quarter billionaire running as the leading contender with a platform that is about more huge, upwardly skewed tax cuts and more deregulation as the centerpiece of his domestic policy. And of course, every Republican candidate agrees with all that. So, yes, it really is astonishing. I mean, the one thing, I guess, where I might disagree with you just a little, Ian, the way that you're characterizing it, is that I think that there are real differences between the political parties on these issues. I think, you know, whatever criticisms one might have, and I would have many, of the Democratic Congress in 2009 and 2010 and of the Obama administration, the policies that they pursued on health care, on taxation, on financial regulation are substantially different and more favorable to the middle class than those that any Republican administration or Congress would pursue. They're not good enough, and there's lots of room for criticism, and they are, you know, very powerfully affected by these concentrated economic interests that we talk about. But there are very, I think, very important differences between the two parties.
But surely, Paul Pearson, the president has not been successful getting his agenda through, and he's not been able to get the Republicans to budge on the Bush tax cuts.
Well, so that battle is still being played out. Much of their agenda did not get through. But look, so we might disagree about this, but the health care reform bill that was passed is going to it's an important redistributive policy. Much of it is being financed by upper-income groups, and many, many more people are going to receive health insurance as a result of it, especially towards the lower ends of the income distribution. The financial regulations were not enough, but it was way more than you would ever get from a Republican Congress. And with respect to taxes, you had tax policies that are more favorable under a Democratic president than you're going to get from a Republican president. So I don't disagree with you at all about criticizing Washington for not doing more for the middle class over the last few years, but I worry about people seeing the two parties as Tweedledee and Tweedledum when, you know, as we put it in the book, as Jacob and I put it in the book, when it comes to these issues, the Republicans wear black hats and the Democrats wear gray hats. They are, their positions are not great on these issues, but they're better than the Republicans.
Well, the thing that I find extraordinary, though, Paul Pearson, is that the Republicans and Mitt Romney actually have a decent chance of getting elected and reelected, because there is so much distress and disquiet out there. One in four homes are underwater. And what's troubling is that it's almost like there's a sort of Stockholm syndrome out there in the electorate, that they are starting to identify with their torturers. Do you think that the president can make a powerful narrative? I know he started out speaking at where Teddy Roosevelt did in Kansas in a kind of opening volley. But it seems to me that given that the Tea Party was formed over outrage about what happened on Wall Street and the left allowed the far right to run with that issue, it feels to me like, you know, there's got to be some more toughness and more clarity.
Well, I think I agree with that, and I think they are. I think the administration is pushing in that direction in terms of how they want to frame their message, and they certainly will if Mitt Romney is the alternative. I think that will be a gift, at least in respect of making sure that people pay attention to these issues of inequalities of economic opportunity. Look, the big challenge, the reason why Republicans have a good shot in this election is not because people are persuaded by an argument that we need more tax cuts for the wealthy or more deregulation. The reason that they've got a good shot is because the unemployment rate is so high. And the unemployment rate is so high because the economy was crashed by Wall Street in 2007 and 2008, and we've had a very, very difficult time crawling back from that, as one might expect. You know, the administration, and again, I don't want to be an apologist for the administration. I have lots of criticisms of practices that they pursued. I think they actually spent too much time hoping that they could craft compromises with Republicans. But they would have done a lot more on these issues if they didn't have to deal with a filibuster in the United States Senate. You know, people think that the majority can just snap its fingers and implement policies. And, of course, this is not, we don't have a parliamentary system where the majority gets to do whatever they want. You know, we have a system increasingly where the minority can tie things up in knots. You know, and if it had only taken 51 votes in the Senate, you would have gotten a much bigger stimulus package. You would have gotten a better health care bill. You would have gotten much tougher financial regulations than what Democrats were able to do.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Pearson, professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book with Jacob Hacker is Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, just out in a new paperback edition. One of the things that managed to get through was the Dodd-Frank Act. And in your piece with Bill Moyers, there was a general consensus that it was very, very weakened and compromised. And now we've noticed that the one piece of legislation that the president managed to shame the Congress into passing, the Stock Act, that's also been compromised as well. So there is something somebody recently referred to as the wealth protection industry operating on Capitol Hill. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely, and I'm not questioning at all that industry is quite influential within the Democratic Party as well as it is within the Republican Party. You know, we spend some time in the book talking about Chuck Schumer as an example of, you know, what we call Republicans for a day. You know, those Democrats who, when it comes to some powerful economic interest within their district or within their state, you know, they're just as much involved in this wealth protection industry as the Republicans are. And so when you add their obstruction to the obstruction that you get from the GOP, it makes it very, very difficult. So again, we're not trying to let the Democrats off the hook here by any means, but we are suspicious. We think it's a mistake to treat the two parties as if they're exactly the same. The challenge is to put tremendous pressure, organized pressure, on the Democratic Party to be more responsive to the middle class and the working class and the poor, and not be so needing to accommodate what you call the wealth protection industry.
Well, Paul Pearson, your book, which chronicles in great clarity how our political system has been hijacked by the super rich over the last few decades. The good news, of course, is that you have a conclusion here, beating winner take all. Walk us through some of the, because I know the Occupy movement has brought a kind of political consciousness to the broader debate about the disparity of income in this country, the 99% versus the 1%. But could you just quickly walk us through some of your recommendations of how the American people can restore a government
of
the people,
and,
by the people?
Obviously, this is the big question. And, you know, a lot of people say that this is a pessimistic book, but we think of it as an optimistic book, because when we wrote it, mostly what people were saying about inequality, you know, and again, people need to appreciate how staggering the shift in income distribution has been in the United States over the last 30 years. 40% of all income growth since the late 1970s has gone to the top 1% of the income distribution. So the slogan of Occupy Wall Street is absolutely right. We are the 99%. That's the right way to think about it. But changing it, obviously, is incredibly difficult. You know, one thing that we stress is, because this is not just the result of globalization or some kind of natural economic process, you actually can change it if you can change the politics. And we've been through this before. You know, another reason for optimism is that we have been through this before. We have been in situations where the system tilted tremendously towards the economically powerful, and you had then periods of political renewal, the Progressive Era and the New Deal, in which things became somewhat more balanced and the system became more responsive to the middle class. So how do you do that? We do think that there are real opportunities associated with the rise of social media, that this makes it possible for people who are scattered all over the country but have similar concerns to organize and to come together. This needs to happen, though, on a sustained basis. It's not something that can happen just for a day or a month or even a year, because what happens in Washington depends on whether people are there for the long haul. Observing what people in Washington are doing and pushing them to do the right thing and holding them accountable if they don't do the right thing. And so if I were to have any criticism of Occupy Wall Street, it's not really even a criticism, but it's just saying, well, what's the next step? The next step has to be, I think, an engagement with the political process in the way that the Tea Party movement has engaged with the political process to try to hold politicians and policymakers accountable. And Occupy Wall Street, I think, has been so far, on the whole, skeptical and dismissive about the need for that kind of engagement. But I think if we're going to turn things around, there have to be efforts that involve trying to advance candidates for office who share the beliefs that people who are concerned about these terrible trends believe, and that then hold those elected officials accountable if they don't follow through.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Pearson, professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book with Jacob Hacker is Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. The book is just out in a new paperback edition. I guess in many ways, though, Paul, the key to changing the political dynamics and getting the kind of majority that you mentioned earlier, you have to have a filibuster-proof majority now in the Senate, and we know the Democrats are at a numerical disadvantage in this election cycle. To me, the key to this is how do you the Republicans only get elected with Democratic voters, and the so-called Reagan Democrats are the ones that they always target and somehow win over. So how do you, from your research, what kind of recommendations do you have for them to win back the Reagan Democrats? Because, you know, essentially what they're being told is redistribution of wealth means that your income is cut so that a bunch of lazy minorities, you know, get to be freeloaders rather than who's really stealing the lion's share of the money.
Right. So, well, there are a number of things to say there. One is that while I do think it's important to try to reach out to all voters who you think would benefit from a different set of policies, and to my mind that means most Americans. What's people often target these Reagan Democrats. They mean, and by that they often mean white working class males. And you know, one thing we need to recognize is that's a less sizable share of the electorate. Every year it becomes a less sizable share of the electorate. So I think to fixate on that group is not necessarily the critical thing. You want to make appeals to that group, and there can be appeals to that group. But I think that you can build electoral coalitions in a lot of different ways, especially given the changing demographics of the country. But the other thing, the broader point I would make about this is that Democrats have to make an effective case for why and how government can actually help the middle class rather than hurting the middle class. And for 30 years, partly because of this incredible organizational imbalance that's developed in the American political system, people have been hearing only about the virtues of tax cuts and deregulation. And mostly Democrats have run away from these issues rather than really arguing them. And I think now is an opportunity. I think people are beginning to understand that sitting here in California, certainly where I am, I think you can start to make a case that says, look, you know, the middle class really has a stake in reversing these policies. And that case has to be made articulately. I actually am hopeful in this presidential election. Again, Mitt Romney is a perfect foil for someone making the case that policies of tax cuts and deregulations have benefited a tiny minority of Americans, and that we need to restore an economic system and a political system that works for the middle class.
But if you are to rescue the endangered middle class, Paul Pearson, and we know that the middle class is in great distress, 1 in 4 homes are underwater, and an awful lot of people are maxed out, and they're susceptible to some of the demagoguery that's going on. So, and we've seen the $26 billion bank bailout for robo-signing, which is barely a drop in the bucket. So it doesn't feel like anybody's really going to the mat for the middle class as much as it's pretty clear that the Republicans are going to the mat for the super rich.
That's absolutely true, right? And that's because there are so many obstacles, right? I mean, this system, the system has become very, very tilted. And there are many ways in which it's becoming even more tilted, right? So we haven't talked yet about Citizens United and the fallout from Citizens United, but the role of super PACs are playing in this electoral cycle is really stunning. Even for somebody like me who has been following, you know, very closely the role of big money in politics, to see a handful of people writing huge checks that are becoming of fundamental importance in how Republican primaries play out, it's pretty astonishing to watch. So the danger, of course, is that given all these obstacles, that any positive movement by political figures is going to be disappointing because it's going to be insufficient. And there's no question in the short run that anybody we elect is likely to be disappointing given all the obstacles that we've been talking about. But the challenge then is not to walk away from that or to say, oh, it doesn't matter or there's no difference, these politicians are all the same. It's to keep pushing. So if you think about the people who built the New Deal or the people who built the Progressive Era, which returned some sanity and fairness to our political process and to our economic system, those were folks who were not in the fight just for one election. They knew that they were going to have to push for many, many years, and that there were going to be many disappointments.
Well, indeed. I guess in many ways, what's encouraging is that our history has proven that, you know, we did have a Gilded Age, not unlike the one that we have now, and the plutocrats outspent William Jennings Bryan of something hundreds to one. And he very recently warned at the end of the 19th century that the great challenge is to protect the God-made man from the man-made God, the corporation. And then we got lucky because McKinley, well, it's a terrible thing to say, but he didn't last very long. And then the accidental president showed up, who was a reformer and caught everybody by surprise, Theodore Roosevelt. And so, you know, good things can happen. But I take it what you're saying is that we need more than leadership there. We need people to show up on Capitol Hill because Capitol Hill is swarming with lobbyists, but they're not swarming with the average American citizen.
Right. So that's exactly right, Ian. And I mean, luck is always helpful. You know, fortuitous circumstances, the right person at the right time. But the only way that those opportunities can be utilized is if people are ready and prepared to push when that happens. And we tell the story in the book. I mean, to me, it sums it up, the situation, as well as any. And it turns out this story may be apocryphal, but it's a great story anyway, where some group of do-gooders comes to talk to FDR in the White House to argue their case about something, and he listens to them, and then he says, fine, you've convinced me. Now make me do it. Make me do it. And what he meant by that was that for me to push something up the hill against all the obstacles in the political system, there have to be people pressuring me and other politicians so that I know it's better for me to do this than to not do it. And that's the kind of situation that we need to recreate. That's the kind of situation that made the New Deal possible, that made the progressive era possible. It wasn't just some magical politician, but it was a talented politician, a dedicated politician who was backed and pushed forward by groups that were encouraging him to do the right thing.
Well, Paul Pearson, I thank you for joining us here today and for your book with Jacob Hacker, Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, just out in a new paperback edition. As I said, Bill Moyer started off his new series with it, and we're starting off our fund drive here with your book because we consider it the most important intellectual ammunition the American people can have to take back their democracy.
Ian, thank you very much for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Pearson, who is a professor of political science at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of Off-Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy, which is co-authored with Jacob Hacker, and he also wrote Politics in Time, History, Institutions, and Social Analysis. His latest book with Jacob Hacker is Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, which is just out in paperback. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the communications director of the Syrian American Council.
Don't ask, don't ask, don't ask, don't ask, oh, yeah.